Can you believe we've already travelled just over 400 kilometres from Port Lincoln to Ceduna, which means we're a quarter of the way to Norseman. If you ask anyone around town here in Ceduna, they'll tell you that their town name comes from the Aboriginal word Chaduna, which translates to a place to sit down and rest. And with 1,200 kilometres still to go, it's a great idea. Our first stop in Ceduna today is at the local weather station. To find it, as you approach from Streaky Bay, you'll pass the Welcome to Ceduna sign, then look for the airport on your left. It's behind the airport on Hastings Road. You can't miss it.
G'day, I'm Paul Wilson. I'm the officer in charge here at the weather station.
Every day at the Ceduna Bureau of Meteorology, just after 2 o'clock, you release something which helps collect data for the Weather Bureau. Talk us through what happens.
Yeah, that's right. Every day at about 2:30, we release a balloon. 54 other weather stations across the country do the same thing at the same time. And what we're after is different wind speed and directions at different altitudes, so we can get like a snapshot, if you like, right across the whole country to show what the weather is doing upstairs.
What kind of balloons are they?
We call them 100 gram balloons. We inflate them to roughly about the size, 1 metre in diameter, and they get to a height of about 16 kilometres. At that height, they actually expand to about 4 to 5 metres in diameter. Well, after the weather balloons burst, it normally takes about an hour to get to burst height. All the stations around Australia, we code up the information that we get from these flights and we forward that information on to head office in Melbourne. And they use that information in their modelling process to ultimately help come up with a forecast. As you might know, if you fly from the east coast to the west coast, it takes you a bit longer because you've got to fly into that headwind. So yeah, they do use that information. Also, at aerodromes where we're stationed, we also provide aerodrome forecasts to give pilots the general conditions of the weather.
How many people come out to watch the releasing of the balloon?
Well, it depends on where you are. If you're in Giles, which is pretty much in the middle of Australia, we get upwards of 200 per month. But out here in Ceduna, we get about on average about 10 to 20 per week.
What are the kind of people that come along to watch it?
Oh, it's a very broad spectrum. I've had people come through the office. They're cycling across Australia. You've got the grey nomads who like to pop in and have a look, and then you get the people who are really genuinely interested and fascinated in what the weather's doing.
What kind of conditions are the best for a positive balloon release?
Sunny skies and no cloud, and not a lot of wind. Okay, so we get the gas comes in through this here, it fills up the balloon, and then to let the balloon go, the machine basically grabs hold of that and pulls it out of that little bung, and then that reseals on itself, and away she goes.
So we're just walking out of the office, walking out over to the release point. Okay. The balloon is going to release at any second. On your marks. Get set. Go. Wow, it's going up so fast. So can you see it all the way up to burst point?
Yeah, I can track it using the radar up to about 250 kilometres, I suppose.
How long does it take to get up that high?
Well, about an hour to get there. It goes up at about 1,000 feet per minute.
From the weather to the green. Let's head to both the start or the end of the longest running golf course in the world. Follow the air highway, but instead of veering left into the town centre, stay in the right lane and travel straight down Coolman Street. Continue down the street, around the roundabout, and you'll see the greens and entry to the golf course on your right. If you're keen to have a hit, you can pick up a playing card at the Ceduna Visitor Information Centre. And if you've forgotten to bring your sticks, you can hire a set of clubs from the centre as well.
My name's Clinton Wern, and I'm the president of the Ceduna Golf Club.
It's a quiet afternoon. There's hardly a breath of wind out. And I'm not sure that's going to help my golf at all, because I'm not telling Clinton, but I can't play golf. We're here at the Sejuna Golf Club. I don't know if you know, but this is the first hole on the longest running golf course in the world. Well, technically it's the first hole, but it could also be the last hole, depending on which way you could be travelling the Nullarbor. Clinton Werne, have you had many people coming through for a bit of a hit?
We have had hundreds and hundreds of people. I think we actually get paid $1 for every person who plays. That's a part of the deal. And we received a large cheque last week, which meant we had about 700 players in the last quarter.
What is that going to do for the finances of the club here?
Oh, it's just a great little bonus more than anything else, you know. So $1,000 here and there goes a long way. We don't have a whole lot of players. I mean, we get about 20 to 30 players on a Sunday for an event, so all the extra money helps.
Where do people come from to play?
All over. You get to speak to quite a lot of people, but we've had people from Canada and various other places around the country as well, so everywhere.
Are they golfers?
Some of them are, and some of them they try pretty hard. A lot of the holes as well are pretty rough and rugged. I mean, we've got our two holes we call it the start of the Nullarbor Links, are probably in the best condition, but there's certainly some other parts of the course that are fairly rugged. There's one at the Nullarbor that's got crows that pinch your golf ball, which is one of the interesting things, and there's a few other things like that as well.
So how many balls have they had flogged by the crows?
I think nearly every person who plays has had a golf ball pinched, so it's almost impossible to keep them away.
So in 2,000 years, they're going to uncover this nest of these crows.
A big nest of golf balls, yeah.
And think, wow, the eggs of this particular bird species were very hard.
And I don't think anyone actually knows why they take them, but they're pretty keen on it, so...
Have you played the whole course?
No, I haven't played any. Apart from these two holes every Sunday, I haven't played any of it. One of our members has, and he thinks he's the unofficial course record holder. I think he had about 120 strokes. His name is Mick Stewart, I'll just mention that.
What do they say is how many shots should you be able to do it in?
Well, honestly, I think some of it's that hard and that rugged that I think if you shot anywhere under 100, you'd be doing really well, I think.
They've got some different names to them. What's this hole one?
The first hole is called the Oyster Beds, and it's basically based around Graham Hofrichter, who was one of the local pioneers for the oyster industry, in recognition, I suppose, more than anything else. So it just goes on to say when it was started, and there's a bit of a sign here that tells us all about the oyster industry in Sejuna. So
oysters have done a lot for the community, haven't they?
Yeah, it is a big thing, so, and they're pretty tasty. So
let's have a bit of a crack. We've traversed our way down to hole two now of Nullarbor Links. This one's called Denial Bay. It's a par four, a 370 metre. And tell us a bit about Denial Bay, or why this was named that.
Oh, it's just dedicated to a fellow called William McKenzie, who was an early pioneer. He was a farmer and used to grow a lot of wheat. And that was what it was dedicated to him, because we've got a fairly big farming industry. He had a saying, I think it's written on the sign here, his slogan was, if you can't grow wheat with your hands in your pockets, and I think it's gone on to be a fairly famous saying.
From the golf club, let's move just a little further up Coolman Street to the Sejuna Aboriginal Arts and Culture Centre to hear about how local Indigenous artists are sharing their dreaming stories on canvas.
My name is Vernon Laurie. My culture background is Murnie. And my dream is the totem is the whale. Whale dreaming at the end of the bite. I was born at Kunuba Aboriginal Mission, about 35 kilometres west of Sejuna. And I work at Art and Culture. I've been at the Art and Culture since 2001. I'm an artist at Art and Culture. And all my painting I do relates to my culture, the whale dreaming.
Tell us about the whales and the dreaming.
Well, years ago, the Moonies used to roam that area, lived there. We go back and forth visiting the head of the bight, camped there with my family, look at the whales, and the whales, like, they relate to us. You know, the wave, the fins and everything, yeah.
How did you get into painting?
I painted all my life. Just recently, I started doing dots in 2000, and then I started expressing my paintings on canvas, whale dreaming, especially Gidra the whale and Gamba the serpent. Another Murnik story called The Whale and the Dolphin Dreaming. The whale and the dolphins are the spirit of the universe. One day the whales and the dolphins were playing in the universe, making all the noise, roaring, rumbling and squealing. The stars began to get real angry with them and said, if you don't stop all the racket, You will be cast in the bottom of the big blue sea for eternity. This is why the whale and the dolphins are still today roaming the big blue ocean for eternity playing.
What are some of your favourite places around here on the far west coast?
End of the Bight. Further down the coast to Canella Caves, the Nullarbor itself, Smoky Bay. We used to live there in Smoky Bay.
If someone was coming over, what's a good bit of Mearning or Gugatha slang that they should know that's clean?
Jubbity means silly, mad. Mixed language, you know, like slang, you know. Oh, you're jubbity. Oh, I don't know how you're doing it, but it just comes out automatically, you know.
Hello, my name's Dolly. My family is the Lorries. My grandfather is Albert Laurie. A Mearning man, originated from Coonabah, and he lived on the Nullarbor. And I want to read the Mearning story. And it goes, in Junja, Mama time, great-grandfather time of long ago, Jidra, the great whale, was a young male, showing off in front of the young women and taking his time in going to ceremony. The seven sisters were watching him and were getting angry at his lack of respect for ceremony. They chased him up the coast. The elder sister took a club from the land and hit Jidra, the great whale, on his head. They had an argument and a little bit of a fight. A big lump was left on Jidra, the great whale, head. Eventually Jidra, the great whale, went on his way, but reluctantly, as he still wanted to play around and show off in front of the young girls and women. The seven sisters followed him from above. They watched his journey. As Jidra, the great whale, neared the ceremony site, he spotted his two friends, the black and white dingo, Juju, walking along the cliff edge. Jidra, the great whale, wanted to get closer to them and push the cliff up so he was right next to them and share their company and talk. As Jidra reached the special place, two penguins, Julia, greeted him as they were there to escort him to the ceremony. But Jidra noticed the seven sisters standing on the cliff edge looking at him. He was still annoyed at them for spoiling his fun. In one last act of defense, he sprayed the seven sisters with his semen. He marked them for life. The seven sisters were now also impregnated. Jidra went on to the ceremony. The seven sisters waited until Jidra finished the ceremony and then watched him go up the coast. The seven sisters went on to have the children. All their children and descendants, Mearning people and whales, bear the sign of Jidra, the great whale, on their bodies to this day. This is why Mearning say they are the children of Jidra, the great whale. And the seven sisters, Mearning people to this day, bear the mark of Jidra on their body to remind who they are and where they come from and who created them. Jidra is also the creator of the cliffs and Nullarbor landscape. You can see along the coast where Jidra has lifted up the land to create the great Bunda cliffs. Jidra often enters the land to be with his companions. He sheds skin and enters the caves along the cliff edges and travels into the caverns, breathing life into the land. Sometimes you can hear Jidra traveling beneath the land by listening to his breathing out of the blowholes and caves. He sprays from spout, creating all the blowholes and caves along the Nullarbor Plains. He comes sliding out of the caves and blowholes to travel across the great land that he has created. When he is majestic, he will come flying out of the caves and blowholes like a bird. Jidra is the creator, the great whale.
Thank you to the Mearning people for sharing their stories. While you're still at the Art and Cultural Centre, go and say hello to Estelle Miller in the Language Centre. She's been working with the community and experts to try and save her mother's native tongue, Wirangu.
The Wirangu people are the people originally from this area, and in the past, when the missionaries came in, the Gugatha people came down to get the rations and were pushed into the missions. Basically, that's when the two different languages started to mix. There was a lot of speakers before colonisation.
When white fellas came here to the Far West, what happened to the Wirangoo people and the language?
It was still strongly spoken till about the early 80s, when the older people started dying off, the language started disappearing more, and more of the Guga language came in and Pidginjarra language came in, till we got down to basically one, two fluent speakers. It was scary, I suppose, knowing that if their language was lost, you know, the culture will be lost with it.
How important is language to the Wirangoo people?
Very important, because, you know, like I said, without the language, the culture would be lost too. Yeah, you need the language to tell the stories of the land.
You said that when the elders started to pass away, that the language slowly started to be lost. Why wasn't it being spoken by the younger people?
Well, I know for me, my mother, she was forbidden to speak her language when she was young, so she didn't pass it on to us. Yeah, the government basically told her, you know, you're not allowed to speak your language at school, and she didn't pass it on.
Were other people in the community still speaking the language?
When I was young, yes. There was uncles and aunties that were speaking the language. I can remember her having conversations with them, but still didn't pass it on to us as children.
She wanted you to be English speakers?
Yes, English speakers. Wanted us to learn English so we can get a better education.
Do you feel like you've missed out on some of that cultural history of who you are because of that, you know, not being able to speak language as a younger?
Yes, I have missed out on a lot, and it would be nice if I was young again just to learn it all, because I'd pick it up quicker, but unfortunately we can't change the past.
How hard is it after all that time to try and collect that?
A lot of the language has been documented from Pastor Hoff. Pastor Hoff was a pastor in Kinniba Mission, and he documented a lot of language while he was at Kinniba. There's a lot of recordings from Tyndale and Daisy Bates, and they got all them things together and, you know, checked up all the languages, made sure that the languages was right, and there wasn't a mixture of... Well, there is a mixture because there's borrowed words. You know, there's no fish in the desert, so can't go out to desert fishing and have a word for fish or seabirds or something like that.
It seems kind of bizarre or almost ironic that it was the white community that came in that wanted Indigenous people to stop speaking language, but through a lot of their efforts and documentation, them writing all that stuff down has actually had a huge role in actually helping to save Wirangoo language.
Yeah, it is. If it wasn't for them documentations, I guess we wouldn't be able to, we wouldn't be where we are today. Yeah, it is very important that it was kept, and I guess we're thankful today that they did collect all that stuff so that we have it for us.
Because Ceduna is the last major centre before Eucla, it's a good idea to stock up on what you might need along the way. Mobile phone coverage also fades in and out over the remainder of the journey, so let family or friends know when you're going to leave and when you might check in next. I'd also recommend stopping for another dozen oysters or so. In the next chapter, we'll have a hot drink made from a native plant. It tastes just like coffee. We'll dive into some local waves and hear about what life was like for three young girls growing up on the Far West Coast. I'll meet you at our next stop, Kinniba, which you can find if you follow the air highway out of town.